You're enjoying Community Radio, KHOI 89.1, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Tom Beal. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Susan, and hi to all our listeners. Though we'll have our phenology report at the beginning of our show and a visit from our sports reporter, Vivica Dillard, at the end, the main part of our program today will deal with citizen lobbying, how ordinary citizens can influence policy. We're familiar with the standard recommendations, handwritten letters, petitions, phone calls, but our guest, Deborah Fink, will have a lot more suggestions.
Now, in our phenology report, we'll hear from reporter Pat Schlarbaum telling us about the newest animal immigrants to Iowa, bears.
Phenology is the recording of nature's happenings when they occur. Signs of the first fox kits to appear each spring or the first pale purple coneflower of summer are noted in a journal. Today's phenology is the appearance of black bears in Iowa. Let's learn more from Vince Evelsizer, biologist with the Department of Natural Resources.
Well, Vince Evelsizer, welcome to Local Talk.
Hi there.
Could you share the report with us, Vince?
There's been a couple so far this year. The two that are probably getting the most attention is that there was a single bear in the Winnesheek County, Allamakee County area throughout the late spring and early summer. So late May and early June is when it was getting spotted, seen the most by folks. And the second bear or bears is in the western part of Clayton County, eastern part of Fayette County. And that bear may have a couple of cubs with it. We're still trying to confirm that.
That was the report that I thought of, because we have had black bear sightings in Iowa in the recent era. When did they last breed in Iowa?
There's a lot of mixed opinions on that. We had bears originally. They were native to Iowa. They are largely wiped out by 1876 was the last documented wild bear shot, and that was near Spirit Lake, Iowa.
Okay.
After that, for several years, 40 to 60 years, there was not very many bears documented as being seen in our state. So starting in the late 80s till now, we've had occasional bears come into our state. There's been occasional reports of cubs, but to our knowledge, none of those have been documented or verified. Mm. So it's possible we had cubs before this summer. But
sure.
These are, if we do get cubs documented here, these would kind of be considered the first documented bear cubs in recent history in Iowa.
And you say they're coming here. Where would you speculate?
I think it's pretty likely they would come from states of Wisconsin or Minnesota.
Okay.
Both have healthy populations.
And what is their legal status here in Iowa?
Bears were largely extirpated or wiped out of our state even before our legislature first convened. So they were not listed as a wildlife species for us to manage. Neither was the mountain lion. So the bear is considered unprotected in Iowa, which means it's not illegal to shoot one or kill one if it is in our state at this time.
Mm-hmm. I was just talking with Bill Horeen. Some of our listeners might recognize Bill started the Story County Conservation Board in 1954. He's 98. And he asked me what I was going to do today, and I said, I'm going to go down and do an interview with a knowledgeable individual that knows about black bears in Iowa. And he goes, oh, I never thought I'd live to hear something like that. And then he said, nature doesn't want us to forget about her. So is there going to be a place for bears in northeast Iowa?
I think time will tell. There's indications that there will be or could be.
Sure.
There is probably enough habitat, good enough food base there to support a small breeding population of them.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if that plays out or not.
Yeah,
but it is a neat thing that we've got some bears showing up in our state.
Well, and Bill would like to think they could guide us to do better, to do more.
Yeah, that's a good way to look
well,
at it.
It is one of a rich and rare resource. So what's going to be in their diet, do you suppose?
There's natural and unnatural foods that they will utilize. And so we hope the bears, and this will be an issue with bears, something to keep in mind and learn about too, is that they can become a nuisance if they eat things like get into bird feeders and beehives or garbage too often. Those are foods that they like as well. Natural foods that they typically would feed on changes seasonally because they're omnivores, so they can eat both plant material and meat. So this time of the year, they would possibly feed on sweet corn or field corn as it gets into the milk stage. And then also a variety of berries that are found in the wood, so blackberries, raspberries, sure, wild strawberries, that sort of thing, all the berries. And then as it gets into fall, they would feed on ripe field corn, and they would also feed on a variety of acorns and other mast.
The acorns. I hadn't thought of the acorns.
Yeah, that's a really rich natural food.
It sure would be.
Up on
there
for
you go.
Winter.
So. Sure enough. Well, you mentioned the bird feeders. I think that is probably one of the learning curves that our wildlife diversity program can bred that. If you are feeding songbirds with black oil sunflower seeds, they do have a craving for those, it seems.
Yeah, definitely.
So we'll be designing and making suggestions on people how to bear-proof their bird feeding operations, I guess.
Yeah, we don't have enough bears that I don't, you know, I think probably raccoons are a bigger common threat, you know, and I think if most people have dealt with raccoons, you can kind of almost consider bears to be real similar with being crafty and wanting to get into the bird feeders.
Oh, that's a real good point.
Yeah.
Sure. If you're vulnerable to raccoons, then you're feeding a lot of raccoons.
Yeah.
And someday there may be a big mammal come by.
Yeah, and sometimes it may mean a temporary stop
cessation
to bird feeding until the winter or something like that.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners, Vince?
Just to give, when we have a bear in the area, the best thing to do is to give them space and not harass them or follow them too closely.
And if reports continue, as the trends seem to be, there will be cubs, and of course that enters a whole different parameter of natural defenses that we don't want to put people in jeopardy. But
yeah, that's a good point, Pat. A mother bear with cubs is going to be a whole lot more protective than ornery. You know, they're simply being a protective good mom to the cubs. So you obviously want to give them space if they do have cubs, because she is going to be protective of them. Last thing you want to do is be between the cubs and her situation.
Always good advice. Yeah, well, I think the previous bears, a lot of rogue or young males coming through the state, and now it's evolved to where we may have some reproduction. It's just quite an amazing thing. And I'll include Bill Hareen's quote once again: "Nature doesn't want us to forget about her," and these bears are presenting quite a message.
Yeah, it is. It keeps things interesting, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Okay. Oh, that's a good place to leave this off, Vince. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pat.
Yeah, see you next time.
Thank you, Vince Evelsizer, with the Department of Natural Resources in the Clear Lake Wildlife Research Station. And that's our phenology for today.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been listening to a report about the new incursion of bears in Iowa and how we may have to prepare for it.
And now it's time for our featured guest, Deborah Fink, who is a longtime citizen lobbyist for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Deb, would you please describe the objectives of this organization and a little about its history and how it operates now?
The Friends Committee on National Legislation, call it FCNL, was founded by members of the Religious Society of Friends, call us Quakers, in 1943. FCNL identifies practical steps that individuals around the country can take to persuade the federal government to advance our country toward the world we seek. We have our mission statement, and I'll read it to you because it's short. We seek a world free of war and the threat of war. We seek a society with equity and justice for all. We seek a community where every person's potential may be fulfilled. We seek an earth restored. That's not too much for today, is it?
You mentioned, Deb, that this was on the federal level, and maybe later as you discuss what your group is doing, you can explain whether you do any local lobbying as well.
Okay.
These are such very ambitious goals. Do you have any concrete things that you feel that you have succeeded in?
Yes. Over the years, we have succeeded. We had a major success just last week when Congress voted to require President Obama to remove the troops, the American troops from Iraq. There's only a few, 500 that he has just sent to Iraq. And we had been working hard on that. And so that's a recent one. We have worked hard on the nuclear disarmament treaties and had big successes. We were very active in passing the Civil Rights Bill of 1963, the spectacular successes over the years. We have persuaded the Senate to pass legislation banning the export of cluster bombs. But mostly we work quietly. The big home runs are big home runs, but the everyday work is working quietly, creating relationships with the staff and the Congress people in Washington, and turning the ship of state very, very slowly, making just incremental changes, and hopefully that these will bring the big successes soon, we hope.
Deb, there's been much said about the division in Congress and the intransigence of some of the members of the Congress. Have you and your group found that they're still open and receptive to persuasion?
Of course, it's different in different offices, and there are offices where we walk into and we know the people and they're glad to see us and we're glad to see them. And then there are some that are not so much. And I don't think we can say that Congress as a whole is intransigent, but some places are more difficult than others. There's one of our main lobbyists in FCNL in Washington who says she likes to talk to people who disagree with her more than the people that she agrees with. And, of course, it's always a challenge. But we, as Quakers, we try to connect with that of God in every person, which can be challenging when we see some of the rough outside. But what we try to do is we try to talk heart to heart with the people that we meet and know that that maybe on the surface we don't agree, but there are deep places that we do agree. And there are cases, and I can't give you one right now, but unfortunately, but there are times when people walk into an office 50 times and plead and get a big no, and then the 51st time they reach. So we try not to give up. That's a goal. Sometimes it can be very discouraging, and if it's a hot, very hot day to walk over to, especially when it's not right across the street, to make that trip over and go into the office where we have a feeling that we're not very much appreciated, but we do it.
I think you said you were the oldest religious lobbying group. Could you expand a little about what that means? How large are you? You said the oldest and the largest. Yeah. And what is it that impresses the Congress people that you talk to? Because I don't know of any who are Quakers.
I don't either. We were founded in 1943 during the Second World War, hoping to influence Congress to work against war in the future. And we have also worked on these other issues that I have named. We are the oldest peace and justice lobby. We are the oldest religious lobby on Capitol Hill. And with 18 lobbyists on staff, of course, we have lobbyists all over the country like me, but on staff working in Washington in our green building, there are 18 paid lobbyists. And I guess we can brag and say the good news is that we're the oldest and largest peace and justice lobby in Washington on Capitol Hill. And the bad news is that we're the largest peace and justice lobbying group on Capitol Hill. Compared with the other rich, very rich, and numerous lobbyists that are all over Capitol Hill swarming, we're a tiny speck. But through the decades, we have gotten some stature because we have excellent analyses and, I believe, a great deal of integrity. And we're close. We have a very good location. We have our green office building, which has been remodeled from being at one time a drugstore, is right across from the Hart Senate office building. So people can walk over and tour the building or just stop in to say hi.
Deb, as small as your efforts are, still it must be quite costly to have so many people there in Washington and your office. How do you pay for the program?
We work hard. We get money from Quakers all over the country, and we get a certain number of foundation grants, and we fundraise. We get a lot of money from non-Quakers, too. I mean, not everybody who lobbies with FCNL, of course, is Quaker or has to be at all. It's very open to everybody, and we have our website, fcnl.org, which encourages people to contribute. But our budget, which is in the $4 to $5 million range per year, is small for what we do, but we try.
You mentioned that you did a lot of research that is very respected because it's very sound and I wouldn't even say unbiased, very honest.
Uh-huh. Right. It is. We have excellent staff people working for FCNL, and they do, you know, over the years they know an awfully lot about what's going on and who's doing it. The other thing that we have that's very exciting, and we're expanding, we have a program. We used to call it our interns, but now we're calling them program assistants, and these are mostly people who have recently graduated from college that are taking a year or two. And they come to work at FCNL, and they get experience usually working on one particular issue, climate maybe. We have a climate lobbyist right now who's a program assistant. And they get experience. They get to know Capitol Hill. They get to know whether this is something they'd like to do. And then they usually move on.
Well, actually, you have now mentioned climate. This was how we got started with the idea for this program, because you recently were involved with the Citizens Climate Lobby that went to lobby in Washington. And we were talking about that as sort of a sample of how citizen lobbyists could get involved. And you gave me several, actually a very large number of tips for people who were not working necessarily through FCNL, who might be sending delegations or might be looking for ways to be more effective. And so do you want to give some of those tips out to our listeners?
Excuse me. I will say that we work in coalition with the Citizens Climate Lobby and other groups, and we were very active in the Citizens Climate Lobby Lobby Day in June. Helping to, you know, our building is right there, and we help to orient people and train people for the lobbying. And we do have rather, we like to give lobby training to the people who are going in, because sometimes it isn't obvious how you do it. And of course, the best way to lobby, the way to increase your effectiveness, is to be organized. and to work in coalition. I mean, if I were going to Washington to want to save the bears of Iowa, it wouldn't have much form or effectiveness. But if you're working on an issue with somebody else in coalition, that helps a great deal. And if you go in to lobby as a delegation or as a group, that increases your effectiveness, too, and it increases the likelihood that you will actually talk with a member of Congress. Often you talk with a staff. But
So going in by yourself is not likely to be as effective as if you have a small group, not so many that it would intimidate them.
Mm-hmm. I go in. Sometimes if I'm the only Iowan there, I'll go in by myself if I happen to be there in Washington. But we do have lobby days. We invite, and we have an annual meeting in November where we invite people from all over the country. And then we'll go in usually. Oh, there might be 10 or 12 people from Iowa. And then we try to get organized. And we have a group leader. And we of course, you always call in ahead or usually email ahead because you can look up the email address and make an appointment to be there. You might get to see the legislator, but probably more often you'll get to see staff. And that can be better because sometimes staff, hate to say it, are more knowledgeable about particular issues than the legislator. And if you can take more of their time and you can also convince them possibly, and then they will take more time and speak with the legislator in depth and from their heart on why they have been convinced that our particular issue, call it carbon fee and dividend, or I can talk a little bit more about FCNL and climate in a minute. But we have a format that we follow. We thank the person for meeting with us. We exchange addresses, contact information, and then we give supporting facts. But this is not the real meat of what we do. If we can personalize it and tell a story from the heart of why we as Iowans feel that this particular measure is really important, and because we have a son who's fighting in Afghanistan or something, we can make this personal. And then we get information, we ask questions, and the staff person or the legislator will ask questions. It's important always, as much as you disagree with somebody, to be respectful and say thank you. And we try not to yell at each other, although I have been yelled at, and this is unpleasant, but it's not the end of the world. It's not the first time I've been yelled at, and you can take it. And then, of course, you write a thank you, usually by email, and then remind them again and that you'll be listening and you'll be following up on this.
Well, these are very valuable on the national level. I think we're going to have a little taped interview that Tom recently did with a candidate for lieutenant governor to use as a jumping-off place for talking about how you might develop relationships with Iowa and even local candidates and why that's important. And maybe at that point you can talk a little more about climate change. Why is that a peace and justice issue? How do the Quakers get that involved? And do you want to say something about that now? Or?
Well, of course, it is. It is definitely a peace and justice issue. The climate, it's the earth that we'll live on, or humans will not be here. And this has been more in recent years, I would say more. We've been more on the environment in recent years, but this is longstanding for the Quakers.
Well, I think we will come back to that issue and also how to use the techniques of lobbying that you use at the national level with state and even local candidates. Just a few days ago, I had a chance to talk with the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor who was in Ames. And I asked her a few questions about why she's running and so on.
Yes, let's listen to that.
Thank you for visiting with KHOI this week. You're in town for a campaign. Well, in fact, you're campaigning across 99 counties. And that's quite a contrast to the experience you had before. You've been on the Cedar Rapids City Council for 7 years, and so you're used to dealing very directly with constituents who can call you up and ask about things or complain about things. This is a whole different experience for you, running on a statewide basis. And how is that experience? What has it been like?
Well, everything to me is all politics are local. You know, I ran for Congress in the first district, so that was a 20 county, so maybe that was a kind of a warm-up act for me. But I won't change. I have my phone number in the book, and people email me, and I answer phone calls, and that's how I will remain. That's why I'm doing this. I like serving the public, and I think we need to continue to have people who are willing to pick up the phone. I actually love it when people send me emails because that's a fast way for me to respond to them, and I have something in writing, and then I can see the email string as I send it to staff. You know, it's different campaigning because when you're a city council member, you can actually say, please get this done.
What would you say are the major issues you're hearing from the constituents? And for that matter, what are you bringing to the campaign? What do you think are the main issues?
Well, I think people are very concerned about education and that Iowa stay as a top state for education. And I think there's concern that we are slipping. I think they're looking at early childhood education. They're looking at post-secondary education. So there's always interest in education. I don't think there's a mom or dad or a grandparent alive who doesn't care about that. I know Governor O'Malley from Maryland, who's been joining us for some of the campaign, he posted it in a very interesting way. He said, how much less education would be good for our kids? And, you know, I got his point exactly. Well, people are also talking about jobs. And sure, we have a governor currently who's talking about creating jobs, but you know, you have to look at the quality of the job, too. And we need living wages. We need to develop jobs that are all around Iowa that I think bubble up from the communities and what they need and what they've decided they need. Infrastructure, of course, you hear. You hear this all the time, bridges and roads. And infrastructure is important because it will put people to work in Iowa. But it also means that we can get our products out to the world faster. So I think those are issues. I'd say the fourth issue that we hear is about the environment, clean air, clean water, climate issues. We've had a lot of natural disasters in our state, and people are paying attention to that. So I think those are some things that we hear about. You asked me something else, and I'm trying to...
Well, let me ask...
What do I bring to it? Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, you know, as a businesswoman, I developed a market research firm and ran it for 26 years. And much of what we did was product to market. So on behalf of Iowa companies, large and small, as well as on behalf of not-for-profits and education institutions, what we did is we looked at what do people need and want, and what does that organization produce? So whether it's Pella Windows or whether it's an Iowa State University education, everybody's got something that they're offering to the world. And I'm used to learning what their markets think about that and helping them to take that out to market. And I think that's a good fit, especially for the vision that Jack and I have, which is really helping the communities throughout the 99 counties bubble up their ideas. We think a stronger Iowa is built by helping neighborhood by neighborhood, community by community, to be the strongest it can be. We would not plan to sit in Des Moines and pick winners or losers. We would plan to work throughout Iowa with any community that wanted to work with us to learn what it is they need and want to make themselves better, what companies in their area want to grow. I think we'd also like to look at the universities and see what types of products or concepts are being developed and how can those go from the laboratory to the production floor and out to the world.
Well, that was the basis, I think, of the extension program for many years. Well, one of the criticisms that the other party has about Democrats is always proposing great ideas and then not providing a way to fund them. How would you fund some of these programs that you've been talking about?
Well, you know, we do have quite a bit of money in the state budget that has not been spent. We certainly have we have a governor who's vetoed clean air, clean water legislation that was had bipartisan support. So I think that there are dollars to work with. And many times it's not as much the money. It's cutting through red tape. It's getting products and services that have already been developed. It's helping them with tax breaks. So I think there are all kinds of creative ways to make these things happen. What I've learned is that you have to invest first in order to make a profit. As a small businesswoman, I saw that all the time. In business, you think of three things. When you make money in business, you either you can reinvest, you pay down your debt, you can reinvest, or you can put it in your pocket. I think as a state, we've got to understand that you've got to invest. And we have all kinds of great, to me, the very best thing you can invest in is your people. And that's through education. So I think that if you really look at the ecosystem that is a state, when you stop investing in your people, and when you stop investing in your infrastructure and in your communities, you are on a downward spiral. And I think there are so many examples out there where that investment reaps great rewards. And I think all you have to do is look at post-World War II United States. We had 30 years there as the best educated nation in the world, best educated workforce in the world. And I think we want to regain that stature, and certainly Iowa can be a leader in that.
One of the challenges that young people have is affording higher education. And Iowa has the embarrassing status of having one of the highest debts for our college graduates of any state. How would you confront that, which I assume you feel is something we need to deal with?
Well, I think that, more assistance as they pay off loans. I also know that one of the reasons why we have the highest debt is because of the wages that their parents have and their inability to help the students as they go through school. So I think it's a multi-layered situation, and I think that it shows this is a holistic kind of a challenge. You don't have education way over here and the economy way over here. They're all related. I mean, just last night I heard Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack speak, and I thought it was fascinating that Iowa is not taking advantage of federal programs the way it should when you look at Midwestern states. We are falling far behind. So when you talk about how we can fund things, even the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, has all kinds of dollars out there to help with economic development, especially with rural communities. So I think that there are ways to get dollars into the communities which help the students, parents, and help them not to have that debt to begin with. So
and you
I think
see
it's
that,
a lot of things.
You see this as a role that the governor and lieutenant governor could play.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's so easy to just say, well, we want to continue to cut taxes and they're going to bankrupt us. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I think that when you look at, for example, some of the dollars during the Culver administration that they bonded for, those dollars helped communities all over Iowa come back from natural disasters. And I happen to be a city council member for one of those that was hit very, very hard, Cedar Rapids. And I know how many state sales tax dollars go into the coffers every year. So you want to keep your communities strong. And we learned in Cedar Rapids firsthand how investing those government dollars, and if you do it wisely, that will spawn private investment. And all you have to do is get in your car and go to Cedar Rapids and see what happened. And sure, there were millions and millions of dollars spent. But today, the community is healthier than ever. And private industry is investing. And so, I really believe that we do have to begin with investment of some government dollars, but always with the idea that private industry also is involved. So I think it's a huge partnership, huge partnership.
One of the contrasts we see is how local government, mayors in particular, have offered to take in some of these children who are being shut out at the border. And this is an issue that you probably feel close to because you, after all, served and has served at the local level. How would you, as a lieutenant governor, confront this question of all of these immigrant children who are being prevented from coming into the country?
Well, I think this is a huge humanitarian issue, and as a mom and as a person who spearheaded the building of the only homeless shelter for women and children in Cedar Rapids, this is an issue that's near and dear to my heart. And I know that people from throughout Iowa, we have been known for our humanitarian efforts, our faith communities, our not-for-profits, our human services, and so I think there's space in our hearts for these children. And I know that we have federal issues we've got to resolve. I certainly am in favor of immigration reform. And I think that most people are. Most people on both sides of the aisle, in the House and Senate, at the federal level, are in favor of this. We've just been stonewalled by a small group. So I think that we need immigration reform. But my heart goes out to these children. And as an Iowan, you know, I have admired for many years what Bob Ray did when I was still in high school. And my life was changed by the families that came into my hometown who came from Southeast Asia and joined us. And I work with an upholsterer in Cedar Rapids, and I think he sent four children through Iowa State University. He's very, very proud that he has four engineers in the family now. It is a bit of a different situation. But I think that humanitarian efforts like this, you don't pause, you don't think about it. I think that if you look at the 2008 law that was signed by then-President Bush, certainly these children are coming here because they are at risk, and some of them have already been harmed. And I don't expect Iowa to take all the children, but I certainly think that we can take our fair share. And I have heard from many, many Iowans who have hearts wide open for the children.
Question of the immigrant children and whether they should come to Iowa and other states. And we'll devote a little more time to that on another occasion. We want to return, though, to our guest, Deborah Fink, who has quite a bit of experience in legislating or lobbying, rather, with legislators primarily at the national level, but in fact some of these techniques that have been effective at the national level can indeed be used at the state and even local level.
Yes, we have. FCNL right now, their major campaign is to when we go into the offices or when we write our legislators, we want them to say that climate disruption is a real fact, that it is caused by it's human caused, and that we need to do something about it to address it. And that is our major campaign right now. And that's even a big stretch right now to get Congress to agree at that. We're working on several levels. When we go to talk to candidates, and I think this is very much a live issue for the elections this year and certainly for the upcoming presidential campaign that is starting very soon. And I would say the question that we are suggesting that people ask every time that we have a chance to talk at a candidate forum or any place else is, what do you envision your legacy to your children and mine would be with respect to the environment?
That's an excellent question. I'm sure it causes many people to think twice about their response.
We want this to be a live issue, and of course, it's up to the citizens, it's up to you and me to define the issues that will be central in this campaign. And the press does this to a certain extent, but it is really the public that should be defining the issues.
Yes. Could you also talk about different levels of people? Certainly the candidates are obvious. You know, the candidates are speaking, and many people just ignore those opportunities. And then you talked about home visits also a little earlier, home visits of our legislators.
Yes. You can go on their websites. Some of them are congresspeople do come back. Sometimes they really want you to know it, and sometimes it's not so much. But you can go onto their websites and ask. If it's not on their websites, you can write them a note and ask them when they're going to be here in Iowa. And I've gone to a number of home visits of the congresspeople. They will be stacked with people who are favorable to this candidate's position. And if you go to a meeting in which most of the people don't agree with you, it gives you a chance to sit in the audience and talk with people who don't agree with you and maybe do some lobbying with this person's supporters, as well as asking the respectful questions and listening and following up with the candidate. So these are very important times. And, of course, it's important to lobby with your neighbors and write your letters to the local papers and to try to get as many people in district engaged in this issue and exercised about this issue, and that this will increase your lobbying effort immensely.
You said something about talking with people who disagreed with you when there's a candidate there, but it's always true. Someone recently called that having the climate conversation.
I have difficulty talking with my brother about political issues, so mostly I don't. But it's an important, maybe you can only talk about one little tiny thing that will plant a seed of maybe a meeting that you can have. But no, it's not just in Washington. Washington is where I happen to be spending quite a bit of time, but my preferred place is here in Iowa.
Well, I think the issues that you've been discussing, certainly climate change issues, are of keen interest to people in Iowa. I think people are increasingly realizing that we have to confront this in a more practical, logical, and thoughtful way, and we can't just deny that it's happening.
No, or we'll feel it anyway.
Exactly.
Well,
thank you, Deborah Fink. Thank you very much for coming in and talk to us about the efforts your group has made to talk with people at the national level and to some extent at the local level on issues that are important to people and the techniques of doing it. Rather than being abrasive and confrontational, your experience has been to be reasonable, thoughtful, courteous, and you're more likely to get a positive response.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure to be here.
And we'll have to follow up on the immigrant children. Thank you a lot, and our last part of our program on Wednesdays is a sports report with our new sports reporter, Vivica Dillard, who is here in the studio. So we'll play a little sports music to make the transition. Hi, Vivica. We're so glad you could join us on Local Talk this morning.
Good morning. Well, I'm glad to be here and to have good sports news for Central Iowa this week. Rolling Story won the first game of the state baseball tournament 4-1 against South Winneshiek. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And we'll go up against North Polk on Wednesday, actually today, at 6 p.m. in Principal Stadium.
It's fun to hear that announcement this morning. We had our shout-out for Roland Story on Monday's Local Talk Show, so we feel like celebrating, too. And I'm so glad that you're including high school sports in your weekly sports update. You know, we represent parts of six counties in our listening area, and high school sports are important to a lot of our listeners.
So I've heard. No. And that's really something that I want to really get into heavily, especially with the fall and football and everything approaching. So, yeah, that's something I'm really looking into getting into.
So many small towns, you know, the local sports, high school sports in particular, so important to the town and to its pride and sense of community.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, these small towns, they take a lot of pride in it. So, you know, I figured the very least I could do is, you know, give them updates on how their town is doing, especially for a lot of the people that are out here that don't get to go home and go to the games every night. So it's a good service.
But it's hard to get that news. The way I found out about Roland Story is my friend Paul Wearson. Well, I'll tell you, Paul was really excited about this game. There are lots of other high school teams that we don't have contacts for. So, Vivica, do you have an idea about how they could contact us?
I do. Actually, you can actually reach us at khoiradio@gmail.com with sports in the subject line. That's our usual email, khoiradio@gmail.com. But be sure to remember to write sports, so I'll be sure to use it.
Because we want to be able to shout out to our listeners and let them know what's coming on so we can feature your favorite teams.
With that being said, I actually do have a couple other sports updates for you. As usual, we're going to start with some basketball. Derrick Rose is back in full threat mode as Team USA made their way to Las Vegas for their first practice. And here's what he had to say about that.
I got invited and take my time and just play the way that I normally play and just enjoy the game and appreciate the game.
Really good news for Bulls fans such as myself. Happy to see Derrick Rose back on the basketball court. Team USA is currently in Las Vegas preparing for the FIBA World Cup, which runs August 30th through September 14th. Also, for NBA news, LeBron James has decided to return to number 23, and the Lakers have reached an agreement with head coach, and former player Byron Scott. They have agreed to a 4-year, $17 million contract. Byron, yeah, I know, right? Byron, who was a star player for the Lakers for 10 consecutive seasons, 1983 to 1993, calls this new coaching job a dream come true. And speaking of Los Angeles, Superior Court judge ruled against Clippers owner Donald Sterling on Monday in his attempt to block the $2 billion sale of his now former team, the Los Angeles Clippers. The team will now be sold to former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer. So that's pretty exciting.
$2 billion. I was thinking how I just have trouble imagining why you would want to block the sale. I know he loved the team, but he didn't. I think we would agree, do a very good job with it.
Yeah.
$2 billion is going to be handed.
Yeah, whopping $2 billion. That's a lot of money. But we're going to switch over to some NBA action. The WNBA legend Lisa Leslie will be inducted into the WNBA, the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame, along with five others. Lisa Leslie won four Olympic gold medals along with two WNBA championships with the Los Angeles Sparks before retiring in 2009. And a quick baseball update. The American League is led by Baltimore in the East, while Detroit and Oakland in the Central in the East. The National League is led by Washington in the East, Milwaukee in the Central, and the Dodgers in the West. With the playoffs starting September 30th, that gives teams like the White Sox and the Cardinals a chance to place their bid in this year's playoffs. And lastly, with the NFL season just 36 days away, teams are putting their final stamps on players' contracts. Yesterday was a big day for the Arizona Cardinals. Patrick Peterson, the three-time Pro Bowl cornerback, agreed to a $70 million five-year extension with $48 million guaranteed. So with all of that money, hopefully he can live up to all the expectations. So Yeah.
Now, is that the sports report or the business report?
Yeah. It's all the same thing. It's all the same. But that actually, you know, that wraps up all the sports that I have for you this week. Hopefully everyone enjoyed that.
Well, thanks, Vivica, and it's great to have you on the staff. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And today we've been talking about Bears, lobbying, and sports. Your hosts today have been Susan Franson and I, Tom Beal.
Our guests have been Deborah Fink, lobbyist for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, Monica Vernon, Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor, Vince Evelsizer, DNR wildlife research biologist, and our reporters have been Pat Schlarbaum and Vivica Dillard. Local Talk is engineered by Rebecca Brown, and our music today is our sports music, DJ Khalid, I'm on One.
That is correct, yes.
Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you'll find an archive for all of our Local Talk shows produced since we went on the air in 2012. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you'll find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com.
Or if you want to give us sports news, just add sports to the subject line. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible.
Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.